credits for completing tasks, and the credits can be traded for special tasks that provide more reward. And what happens when people earn enough reward credits? Straker figured they would buy residences or vehicles, travel or take vacations, eat out and party, invest in businesses or buy art. What did people do with money anyway? He'd had so little time and opportunity to use it during his life, he hardly knew. He mused that he must have a lot piled up in his military pay accounts in the 100 worlds. Not that he'd ever get access to it, of course. "They can buy things," Don replied. "But they seldom do." "Really? Why not? What do they do with the credits?" "They move up to higher reward tiers, where they actually have to risk their credits in hopes of winning more." "Risking? Winning? That sounds more like gambling than work." Straker knew something about gambling, from Shangri-La or from the usual games troops played, wagering drinks or luxuries or hard cash when they had it. He'd never been all that interested in playing those games, which had made him that much more of an outcast, until he'd made enough rank he wasn't expected to play anyway. "It is gambling, but it's never called that." "What happens when they win a lot, when they get rich?" Don smiled without humor. "What do you think rich people would do?" Straker hazarded a guess, not that he was particularly familiar with rich civilians. "Become entrepreneurs or big business people or celebrities, entertainment stars? Do they go on planetary cruises and drink the finest wines or run for elected office, gain power?" "You'd think so. But with rare exception, no." "What do they do then?" "They keep gambling, bigger and bigger, until they lose it all and fall back to the working level, where the rewards are small and so are the risks, where all they have to do is show up, put their minds on autopilot, and slave away." Straker stopped and turned to face Don. "Are you trying to make this about me? That I'm gambling always bigger and bigger until I lose? Is that how you see yourself?" "That's how people around me see me sometimes. My woman, my wife, Carla, I mean, says so, sometimes. That I can't keep from gambling, but my gambles aren't to win a vacation or more credits." Don opened his hand and made a there-you-are gesture at those around them. "Neither are theirs, really. If they really wanted that vacation or those credits to actually build lives, they'd take them and stop gambling. But they don't. Because it's the game that matters, not the gain."
"And you think I'm the same?"
"That's not for me to answer." Straker turned away, sucking breath through his teeth and thinking. "The difference is I have a goal. I want to free mankind. You've brought me here to a place where a different branch of mankind is enslaved in crazy ways, but it's really the same old shit. Happy slavery with people that don't even know they're being controlled and manipulated is still slavery."
"As it was with you."
"As what?"
"When you were a mech suitor."
"I was happy. I was. I had a purpose, a noble purpose. I thought."
Straker rounded on Don, angry.
"Okay, you got me. You and your word games. Maybe I was being manipulated before. I sure don't know the full story, but I broke out of all that. I made my way out, and I made a real difference. I've freed more than half of humanity from a tyrannical government, and I'm planning on liberating the rest."
"The rest?"
"The 100 worlds.
"Hmm."
Don's eyes narrowed.
"That's a great speech for a trainee. I'm glad you're enjoying your role-playing."
Straker nodded, realizing he'd been skimming close to speaking too plainly inside the diz. If anyone were listening, they might start to wonder. So he slipped back into his role.
"Just trying my best, boss. I have to learn to act like the humans."
"You're certainly making progress."
Don turned away and Straker followed, his mind a whirl with the things the Opter man got him thinking about. Don led them to another diz, called Milgram. This one consisted of rooms behind one-way glass. Each room was divided into two parts, reminding Straker of the chambers with the court readying itself to eat a naked Carla Engels. Don halted Straker to observe one pair of rooms. On one side, a white-coated researcher with a large hand tab opened a door and let in a young woman in ordinary clothing. "Sit here," the man said, and she sat in a chair before a table with two large buttons, one red, one green, and a standard screen. In the other chamber, a young man, Facet, Straker reminded himself, was strapped to a table and wired with leads to machinery.
"What's going on?"
the woman asked. "Simply read the screen into the microphone," the researcher said.
"What is 6 times 5?
Recited the woman into a microphone. Her voice was evidently carried into the chamber with the helpless prisoner, for the man on the table answered,
30. "Now what?" she said.
"Push a button," replied the researcher. The woman tentatively reached over and pressed down on the big green button with her palm. The prisoner immediately moaned and writhed. Straker thought at first the man was in pain, but it soon became evident he was experiencing pleasure. Straker looked back at the civilian woman. She was smiling, her eyes alight. When she was given more questions to ask and the man got them right, she pushed the big green button and he moaned with more pleasure. Now the woman was licking her lips, her face was flushed, and she breathed deeply. Clearly she enjoyed meeting out pleasure. The researcher tapped his hand tab. The readout screen scrolled. The civilian read the words on the screen and spoke.
"What is 10 plus 2?
12, the prisoner said. The civilian leaned forward to slam her hand on the green button, an expression of slack fascination now fixed on her face. The researcher tapped his hand tab and the screen scrolled to a new question.
"What is the square root of 30 to 6 decimal places?
The prisoner's eyes darted.
I don't know.
The woman leaned forward and, after a moment's pause, triumphantly slammed her hand on the red button. The man writhed again, though this time it was clearly in pain. He cried out,
"Stop, please, stop. Stop this,"
Straker growled, looking for a door into the research rooms but not seeing one. "This kind of brainwashing shit is exactly why I liberated the Mutuality." Myrmidon didn't move.
"You can't stop it. This is part of the Diz process."
"Hell if I can't. You said they don't police the Dizzies, right? Whatever happens, happens."
"That's correct. For the ordinary facets. You, however, have been tagged as an agent trainee. You'll be seen as interfering."
Straker clenched his fists and forced himself to watch. The woman seemed just as aroused by the man's agony as she had been by his pleasure a moment ago. In fact, when the system suspended the pain, she slammed repeatedly at the red button, even when it did nothing. She made a sound of frustration.
"Next question,"
she said, turning to the researcher.
"Next question."
"You're turning people into sadists," Straker said.
"Give them an authority figure and instructions, power and rewards, and people do what you say."
Don shook his head. "Did you hear the researcher give any instructions on which button to push?" Straker thought back.
"I guess not. So she could push either button?"
"Of course."
"But you cued her which was pain and pleasure, red and green. That's assuming these facets associate green with positive and red with negative, like standard displays or traffic lights."
"The choice is hers. Yet, like most young human facets, she doesn't care whether she meets out pain or pleasure. Both excite her. Combine that with her unconfirmed assumptions, such as the assumption that rewards go with right answers and punishments go with wrong ones, and she might just torture this man to death."
"You let them do that?"
"They're only facets. The controllers do what they have to in order to achieve their greater goals, just like we do."
"I don't."
Myrmidon faced Straker fully.
"Oh, no? With your combat skills in biotech, you could have disarmed those police officers in Baltimore. You could have broken up the brawling at campus. You could try to break this glass and rescue that poor fellow on the table. Why don't you?"
"Because
You told me... Straker realized what he was saying. Because you're my authority figure. It's not because I'm afraid.
Did I bring up fear?
Is it important that you be seen as brave?
Straker's fists clenched.
Getting caught here would be pointless, that's all. I might save one man or two, but I can't save the thousands...
Billions.
Okay, billions of facets you're destroying in these dizzes.
So you're doing what you have to do in order to achieve your greater goals. You're ignoring your moral principles because of practical concerns.
The man on the table screamed again. Turn that shit off!
Why? So you won't have to face it?
Straker punched Myrmidon in the jaw. The Opter man, only a facet after all, sprawled, knocked out cold. By the time Myrmidon came to, Straker had mastered himself. Besides, he couldn't seem to open the door to the room, no matter how hard he kicked and pulled at it, nor break the transparent window material. He faced the fact that he couldn't go save the poor souls strapped to the table. He'd managed to ignore the screams and groans, telling himself that the prisoner was unlikely to die, though death itself had little to do with torture. He'd even figured out what Myrmidon was doing. Maybe. When Don sat up, rubbing his jaw ruefully, Straker squatted next to him.
Sorry about that.
I expected it, actually.
But you're so damn fast.
Be glad I didn't hit you as hard as I could have.
Gee, thanks.
I know what you're trying to do.
Getting punched?
Straker chuckled. The whole thing, the why. This isn't just a diz for these facets. It's for me.
Don raised an eyebrow.
Why would I do that?
You're not just testing and corrupting these people, you're testing and corrupting me.
People corrupt themselves, Derek. Nobody can do it for them if they really want to resist.
Testing you?
Of course.
More importantly, you're learning.
Don stood, brushing himself off.
Not only are there many different dizzes, there are meta-dizzes. We all go through them. We are observed, then we observe. Then we observe the observers. Sometimes we even observe those who are observing the observers.
Straker stood also, wondering who was observing them.
Is that why humans call, us opters? Something to do with optics, eyes, observing?
Don chuckled.
An astute guess. But no, just coincidence. Opter came from one of the first humans to encounter insectoid facets. Hymenoptera is the human name for the order of insects comprising wasps, bees, and ants.
I guess hymens would have been weird.
Sure would.
So did I pass your test?
The jury's still out, but you're coming along.
Straker rubbed his face with his palm as if to scrub off dirt.
Why are you showing me all this? What if I do pass?
Finally, you're asking the right questions. Unfortunately, that's above my pay grade.
Make a guess, Straker said.
Perhaps those above me will take stronger measures in your favor.
The misscore, he meant,
though Myrmidon couldn't confirm it aloud. Trusted agents like Don were given lots of slack to train their protégés, he'd said, but Straker didn't want to give whoever was watching cause to really wonder. Probably the very unlikeliness of a real human agent infiltrating Terra Nova, combined with any system's usual complacency when presented with what it expected to see, had protected them so far. Straker had already done some pacing and thinking while waiting for Don to regain consciousness, and now he continued.
I think there's more to it than you're telling me. Every time I think I know what's going on with you, there's another layer, another twist, and you told me I couldn't possibly beat you at your own game of secrets.
That's true.
But this is a game you hope I win, because if I win, you win. You want me to figure this stuff out instead of spoon-feeding me, I get that. People don't value what they don't work for, so you're making me work for these lessons.
That seems reasonable. I've been told that personal experience colors everything anyone does. We think we're objective, but really we have a lot of unrecognized assumptions. The queens, for example, live their lives surrounded by drone slaves. They're the only ones with free will around them, other than fellow queens and aliens. Except, Straker snapped his fingers as he paced, trying to corral a fleeting thought. Except for us. Us, human facets. Once we make it through all the dizzes and all the experiments and games, once we're sharp enough to blend in with the humans, we've developed free will and individuality. We're no longer really facets.
An interesting observation. Myrmidon's bland eyes, nevertheless, seemed to be watching Straker closely.
So now we have a whole world brimming with potential individuals, and we're training them to have free will, to make choices, even bad ones. Some make it through, some don't. It's all very Darwinian. But the fittest survive. Some are good, some are evil, but they're all queens in their own right, individuals. Like you said, perfect copies of imperfect humans.
You seem to be building a coherent picture.
So by your logic, we're both human.
That is so.
Straker stopped and stared, unseeing, as the researcher on the other side of the glass led away the protesting woman. She seemed to want to go back to her button pushing. In the other room, medics attended to the tortured man.
So hypothetically speaking, Straker watched Don carefully for any hint he should shut up.
Hypothetically, if we were real humans and saw all this, we'd want to rescue these people, and we'd hate the queens.
Stipulated.
In fact, if I were this liberator guy, I'd think this planet was primed for revolt.
If you were this liberator guy, it would be natural for you to come to this conclusion.
But since I'm not, and since we, Sarmak, want to keep the humans out of our business, we'll need to make sure the Liberator never finds out about this planet.
Don made a dismissive motion. It's far from human space.
No worries, then.
None.
Okay.
Straker clapped his hands in satisfaction. Finally, he felt like he was starting to understand Myrmidon.
I'm hungry.
Let's go to the cafeteria.
Is it part of the Diz? Will they be testing weird foods on us?
Don pondered.
I'm really not sure.
Without warning, the door to the room burst open. Straker reacted immediately, dodging out of the way as stunners fired. Myrmidon fell. Men poured into the room. There was nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Straker got his hands on one of the attackers, but his muscles locked and his nerves blazed from repeated stuns. They pummeled him into unconsciousness.
Chapter 9. Admiral Lucas Braga, Calypso System. As his 10th Fleet entered Calypso's planetary nebula at C1, Admiral Lucas Braga sat upright in his flag chair, hands firmly on its arms and feet flat on the floor. Appearances were important, and he always maintained his image as a by-the-book commander. Not so by the book that he hadn't brought along Captain Lydia Verdura to command his flagship, the HWS Luxembourg. It was good luck that she'd also survived Corinth, and good fortune that the boards of inquiry had found them both guiltless in the debacle. In fact, he'd been promoted to fleet command for the current offensive against the Hawk. Admiral Danica Downey, however, had been posthumously court-martialed and convicted of dereliction of duty. This provided Braga a tiny sliver of satisfaction, yet failed to balance the anger he still felt at the loss of life and ships the stupid, politically connected officer had caused. He shook off haunting memories and concentrated on the business at hand. His holotank, a proper device for a proper flag bridge, showed his fleet maintaining maximum search dispersion while still keeping his ships and scout drones networked.
"The enemy defense force is eliminating the probes we dropped outside, sir," said his sensors officer, Lieutenant Lexan. Like most of his best technicians, he was a Ruxan.
That reminded Braga of that annoying but innovative Ruxin who had almost, almost snatched victory from the jaws of defeat at Corinth with his stealth mind trick. What was his name? Zaxby, that was it. Too bad he hadn't survived.
Save the probes for later, said Braga. We'll need them to scout our departure path after we destroy Felicity Station.
Sir, why do the Hawks sometimes use human names for their installations?
Asked Lexan. The others of his flag crew seemed to listen closer. Rumors had been swirling for some time about the troubles the Hawk were experiencing with the upstart warlord called the Liberator or some such. Fleet intelligence had provided far-fetched guesses that, in Braga's opinion, only made things more confusing for the rank and file. The Parliamentary Intelligence Agency had provided separate, eyes-only briefings for senior officers, revealing what the Flag Corps had long suspected, that Hawk aliens were in league with human traitors, who existed in far greater numbers than he'd thought. Whole planets full, in fact, allowed to prosper within the Hawk Empire. That explained the occasional human defectors and captured prisoners. Braga wished the PIA would simply reveal the truth, rather than try to keep it under wraps. If his own feelings were any indication, the average fleet crewman would fight even harder when they found out about the traitors. But now he had to come up with an answer to Lexan's question, or deflect it without revealing classified information.
I can't really tell you, Braga said, which was technically the truth, though misleading. Maybe Intel uses the Earth in translation for the Hawk word, or maybe they simply assign a name.
He didn't like playing semantic games, but his only other choice was telling them the answer was classified and that might reveal more than it concealed.
But attend to your duties, Lieutenant, Braga said sharply. I know you think you can split your attention, but I'm not so confident.
Aye, aye, sir.
Lexan turned his eyes and tentacles back to his consoles. A moment later, the holotank identified a new contact.
Fixed Felicity dead ahead. Emissions consistent with Felicity Station, though faint.
Probably powered down as much as possible, Verdura mused.
Lexan continued.
I'm getting some intermittent contacts with our periphery that concern me.
What kind of contacts?
They might be ships. They are at extreme detection range, but occasionally the vagaries of the gas dispersion allow sensor distance extension, and one of our scouts or probes gets a hit. We've also lost an unlikely number of probes, even accounting for the enemy mines. Lurking enemy ships would explain both phenomena.
What kind of ships?
Lexan tweaked the holotank.
Tentative identifications range from cruisers to super dreadnoughts.
Braga gripped the arms of his chair.
Is that possible? Capital ships in the nebula with us?
Self-evidently, it is possible, sir,
Lexan said with the hint of supercilious annoyance characteristic of his kind.
Average sensor range is barely 100 kilometers, and the nebula's diameter exceeds 1,000,000 kilometers. However, I cannot judge the likelihood of enemy capital ships being present. That is a strategic question beyond my current competence.
Braga thought furiously. Could the enemy be laying some kind of trap for him? He thought about the string of operational decisions he'd made since arriving at the Calypso system, and reluctantly concluded it was possible. Fortunately, his fleet was robust and well-supplied.
Pass to all ships, each to launch 2 active probes outward on the same mark. Choose a mark that will allow for a coordinated launch. On the same mark, push our scouts out an extra 100 kilometers.
Aye, aye, sir,
the flag comms chief replied and set her subordinates to issuing orders. When the mark came, the holotank view expanded suddenly, like an inflating balloon, to show...
Bogies at Globiga, sir, Lexan reported. Over 100 capital ships. They're still moving into position.
Shit,
Captain Verdura said, swiveling her chair to face Braga's.
We have about 5 minutes, sir.
She visibly restrained herself from barking orders, like a hound quivering to bolt after a fox, as she waited for Braga's instructions. Braga ignored her, staring at the holotank, using a full minute of the 5.
The enemy ships he could see appeared to outmass him by 2-1, even adding in the usual 10% advantage of Hundred Worlds technology ship for ship. He'd suddenly gone from comfortable to vulnerable, and he was acutely aware of his inability to see far. No doubt the enemy had better intel. The way ahead seemed thinly held, though. It might be a trap, but it also could be his salvation. He might yet pull these chestnuts out of the fire and accomplish his mission to boot. Braga snapped rapid-fire orders. Light units to the fore, maximum minesweeping and recon mode. Fleet to accelerate at 1/4. Heavy cruisers to back up the lights and attack Felicity Station as soon as it comes within range. Carriers full attack ship and drone launch to supplement our perimeter. All other units to maintain vigilance. We're assaulting through the ambush, and we'll fight our way out the other side as soon as we've destroyed the fuel processing plant. His staff scrambled to pass his orders through the network. Attack ships and remote drones blossomed from the carrier launch bays and spread out. Asteroids and moons seemed to leap toward the fleet as his ships accelerated as fast as they dared. Point defense weapons worked overtime to pick off chunks of orbital debris and enemy mines. Ships rocked with explosions and impacts, as those efforts sometimes failed. His heavy cruisers came into direct fire range of the Felicity Station Moonlit, a lumpy hunk of rock and dust over 100 kilometers across, and began their bombardment. Missiles and railguns blew pieces of it off into space, and the processing facilities identified by their EM emissions were wiped out. But even under intense attack, it would take a while for such a large installation to be dismantled. Braga watched closely as the enemy englobement tightened. The advantage of such a formation was twofold. First, it allowed all the attackers to point their biggest weapons and their armored noses at those within the globe, while the defenders had to either run and expose their vulnerable sterns to a rake, or form a spherical hedgehog pointing outward, becoming immobilized. Second, the englobement aimed to trap all within, leaving nowhere to escape, the three-dimensional equivalent of surrounding an enemy on the ground. The standard doctrinal response for the defender was to charge ahead, concentrate fire, and blast out of the trap. Some would fall, but many would escape, and fleet cohesion would be maintained. Braga was nothing if not a man of doctrine. Sticking to the well-established principles of war had brought him victory many times. Still, the mission always came first. He would take unexpected casualties, but destroying this Hawk fuel factory would save lives in the long run. So, he ordered, "Heavy cruisers continue bombardment as long as possible. The rest of the fleet will maintain formation, leapfrog forward, and fire at targets as they present themselves. Light units collapse upon our capital ships once the enemy has committed himself, and take up station as our rear guard." His superb ships, operated by experienced crews, carried out his orders with precision. The heavy cruisers pulverized the moon, and presumably its facilities, though from the first those dying installations were hidden by a heavy screen of dust and debris, thrown up by impacts and explosions. His main armored fist, his phalanx of supers and dreadnoughts, passed around the cruisers in a ring, backed up by battle cruisers. Anything conceivable that got in their way would get hammered to scrap. But then, the inconceivable appeared. Out of the gas in front of his fleet leaped what looked like a tiny ship, approaching at a blazing speed far in excess of what he would have thought possible within the nebula. It smashed into the armored nose of the super-dreadnought Bruxelles, doing grievous damage to her. She'd still have engines and point defense weapons, but her value as a fleet asset had been eliminated with the destruction of her primary spinal weaponry and front armor. "What the hell was that? Some kind of suicide craft?" Braga barked.
"No, sir," Lexan answered. "By sensors show, it was a solid crystal projectile of approximately 900 tons, a railgun bullet."
"Where?" Before he could ask his next question, the holotank recorded another disaster as HWS Antwerp reported catastrophic damage from a massive particle beam strike.
"All ships, maximum evasion," Braga snapped. "There must be a fortress in front of us. Locate it and counterfire."
"The Beeves' back azimuth is evident to all ships, sir," said Lexan. "They're launching now." Hundreds of missiles sprang from his ships, even from the two crippled SDNs, whose side-mounted launch tubes were still functioning. At the same time, a storm of railgun and beam fire converged along the track of the enemy shots. Not even a monitor could mount weapons so large, so Braga knew there must be a fortress out there, and a fortress couldn't maneuver. The enemy's surprise had been costly, but it would ultimately be futile. Suddenly, another monster railgun bullet speared the super-dreadnought Rotterdam, this time from a different angle. The projectile caught her aft of amidships and tore her less armored stern off, leaving her a tumbling wreck.
"Two fortresses," Captain Verdura cried. "Maybe more. Sir, the englobement's driving us into a kill zone. We can't stand up to fire like this."
Before she even finished her sentence, another particle beam struck HWS Friesland, opening her up like a tin can and igniting a line of plasma fire along one flank. Four of Braga's proudest and finest ships wrecked within 2 minutes, and he couldn't even see his attackers. Despite the shock, Braga's mind kicked into overdrive. His brain chips and his experience allowed him to analyze what he saw in the hollow tank and extrapolate outcomes, even with hundreds of ships and variables. The enemy's intention became clear. The Hawk and their human traitor allies had laid a titanic trap for him, knowing the Hundred Worlds would come after the tempting target of Felicity Station. The cowardly defense had lured him onward. The relieving fleet had driven him inward, and the englobing ships had forced him forward into these massive siege guns, weapons against which he could not stand. His turbocharged brain searched for solutions. Reverse course and run? His fleet had too much forward velocity. Charge blindly onward, firing at the fortresses when they could be seen, risking collisions with asteroids and moons in order to break through? If he had to. But he saw the narrowest of windows in a third option. "All ships change course, 45-degree angle, planetward, 30 degrees port, flank acceleration. Ships to fire at will, maximum defensive protocols. We'll skim C-1's atmosphere and slingshot around the planet. That'll avoid these fortresses and degrade their targeting."
"Helm, comply," Verdura said to her ship driver. "All weapon controllers fire at will, defensive protocols."
As one, Braga's fleet blasted downward and to port. He hoped this would surprise the enemy, who should be expecting him to try to immediately break for the outside of the nebula. Instead, this course drove the core of his still powerful task force between the big guns in front of him and the englobing fleet. Unfortunately, it left his slowest and most damaged ships to fend for themselves. The carriers particularly would never make it out. It pained him to think of those crews and supplies falling into enemy hands. But his responsibility was to salvage as much as he could, converting a potential disaster into a mere debacle. Better to limp home with half a battered fleet than to stand and die to no purpose, especially as he knew he'd already destroyed Felicity Station. His fleet's sudden turn brought several enemy ships directly into his fleet's primary cone of fire. Despite defensive protocols, most of his captains ordered their ships to aim their largest weapons at their foes. Those enemy vessels tried to evade and fall back to their comrades, but they were smashed out of the way, tearing a hole in the englobement. Braga couldn't blame his people for their lust to strike back, and he couldn't fault their judgment at destroying what was in front of them. He only hoped that without his carriers for resupply, his stocks of fuel and ordnance would hold out long enough to get home. Over 60 of his ships broke free of the trap, using the planet's gravity to add to their acceleration. The rest had been crippled, destroyed, or surrounded, forced to surrender. Braga ground his teeth, but focused on what fleet he still had and how to get it out. The lightest, fastest units of the enemy englobement streamed behind him in a ragged chase, firing at the sterns of the Hundred World ships. Braga's vessels continued maximum evasion, varying their courses and dodging as much as they could, even while maintaining a loose formation. Designated ships, as fast as cruisers, cut their engines and turned briefly broadside to use their point defense weapons against pursuing missiles. They would then reorient on impellers and resume running. They also dropped mines in their wakes, forcing the pursuers to either slow or risk a nuke on the nose. These and other tactics, along with the edge and speed and weapons technology of Braga's ships, gave him hope. His harried fleet skimmed low over the swirling atmosphere of the gas giant designated C-1, gaining speed. They smashed through hundreds of rocks in orbit, and he lost one of his battle cruisers when it plowed right into a moonlet that loomed out of the gas, too large to destroy or dodge. Braga hissed through his teeth in frustration. He'd accepted the risks when he decided to run. "On my mark, new course," he said, once most of the pursuers had fallen away. "Stellar absolute, zero azimuth. We'll dive toward the star, get lost in its corona, and perform another slingshot." "Orders relayed," his flag comms chief replied. "All ships standing by. Mark." Now his fleet turned outward, heading toward the small orange star of Calypso. In just minutes at this breakneck speed, they passed through the gas cloud surrounding the planet and broke out into open space. Braga's optimism died a brutal death as the holotank updated to show nearly 200 enemy ships waiting for him dead ahead, centered around that damned monitor. They opened fire. Chapter 10 Straker on Terra Nova. When the stun wore off, Straker awoke, strapped to a reclining table in a laboratory. Mechanical arms hung from above, quiescent. Machines hummed and beeped now and again, and sophisticated holographic readouts displayed biological constructs. He flexed and strained at the straps, but he was held fast. Even his extraordinary strength barely budged the restraints. A woman in a lab coat entered the room. Her name tag read Smith, and she looked to be about 20 years old, a knockout redhead with a short skirt and lots of cleavage. She reminded Straker of a younger version of Tashina. She stepped over to a console and began inputting commands there. "What's going on?" Straker asked, controlling his anger and concern. His only chance of getting out of this was to play along with his cover as Myrmidon's spy trainee.
"I'm continuing to test you," Smith replied.
"For what?"
"Deviance from genetic norms."
"Why?"
"I have no idea."
The woman tapped one final tap, and she swung her swivel chair around to face him, legs apart. He could see up her skirt to a triangle of pink panties as if she had no idea how to be modest. Or maybe she was doing it on purpose. But she didn't seem to be acting coy or flirty.
"I'm just a lab tech," she said. "Now hold still while the machine takes the samples, or I'll have to paralyze you."
The arms above him activated and stabbed him suddenly with needles in several places. The pain was negligible, so Straker froze. Getting paralyzed was the last thing he wanted. He wondered how mature Miss Smith was, how far through the humanizing program she'd gone. Was she naive or cynical? Had she ever had a lover, or was infatuation and sex foreign to her? Worth a try, Straker thought. When the arms had retracted and placed their samples into other machines, he put on his best charm. "Hey, what's your first name?"
"Doris."
"You're gorgeous, Doris. Anybody ever tell you that?" Doris blushed and covered her mouth with her hand.
"Me? No. Nobody ever said that about me."
"Well, it's true.
Come over here, and let me see you better."
Doris rose and walked to within arm's reach, if his arms weren't firmly held. She stared him in the face, seemingly innocent of guile.
"You're gorgeous, too. What's your name?"
"Derek."
"Derek what?"
"Just Derek. They haven't assigned me another name. I'm still in training."
"For what?"
Straker winked. "It's a secret." Doris blushed again.
Telling me would be improper.
It would.
But I'll tell you anyway,
if you like.
I'm not sure.
Doris seemed both repelled and fascinated by the prospect of doing something improper.
You have to promise not to tell anyone else.
Then it'll still be a secret, so it's okay.
I suppose that complies with the guidelines.
Sure it does.
Lean closer, so I can whisper it.
Doris leaned her face close to Derek's. He smelled her breath, sweet and unspoiled. He almost felt bad about manipulating her this way, but he had to get out of these restraints. After that, he could figure out a way to escape from this bizarre Diz planet.
I'm training to be a spy, to infiltrate the humans. Exciting, huh? Oh, that's much more exciting than my job.
Doris kept her face close to his, staring into his eyes.
I like you.
I like you, too. Have you ever kissed anyone?
What's that mean?
Apparently, this young woman, young Facet, really, had simply been trained for her work, but not for social interaction, and in the manner of the insectoid opters, her masters assumed she would simply act like an organic robot and carry out her task. If Straker's guesses were right, this left her with all the usual physical urges, but no filters and no experience.
Kissing is when you put your lips on my lips. It's pleasant. You want to try it?
Doris leaned in and pressed her mouth to his, clumsily. Straker did his best to make the kiss lively but tender. As the seconds went by, the lip lock became more heated and intense. Suddenly, Doris crawled onto Straker, straddling him and seizing his head in both hands, kissing him as if trying to devour his mouth and tongue.
Oh, this is wonderful, she gasped. Let me out of these straps, Doris, and we can do more.
Doris punched in a code to the table, and his restraints popped off. He wrapped his arms around her and kissed her for a moment just to make sure she was thoroughly lost in the experience while his eyes roved the room. There was only one way out, and the door had a keypad lock. And his unauthorized freedom could be discovered at any moment. Somebody must be watching, or would soon. He briefly wondered if this was all part of the Diz, the experiment, a scenario within a scenario. Did it matter? He would act the same way no matter what, and according to what Myrmidon had said, nobody would save him or go easy on him, if it were. They might even kill him. Better to die free than live in a cage.
Let's go somewhere else, Straker said around kisses. Your room? Yes, Derek. My room. I want to keep doing this forever.
Doris dragged him by the hand to the door and hastily input the code, and then pulled him out into a second room. This one had more lab equipment and two doors. She led him toward one.
The other door is guarded. This is the emergency exit.
Won't an alarm sound?
I don't care.
Before he could stop her, she pushed the door open and went through, her hand still firmly locked to Straker's. A loud beeping pealed from speakers, and they ran down a corridor past other doors. After a moment, those doors opened and others joined them in their race, paying the two no attention.
Of course, Straker thought.
They were just two more people in a crowd evacuating the laboratory building, presumably for fire or other emergency. By chance, Doris had facilitated their escape. They debouched into a parking lot. People continued to stream out of the doors.
Will they miss you if you leave right now? Straker asked. I'll check in, she replied, leading him toward a tall box standing among the parked vehicles.
People were lining up to scan their faces into its sensors, apparently for post-emergency accountability. Doris got into the line and soon had recorded her safe escape.
Now we can go. I'll report myself ill from my quarters communicator.
Do we take a ground car? Straker asked.
No, I'm too junior to have one, she said. It's all right. My flat is an easy walk from here.
She dragged him possessively toward it. A commotion behind them made Straker turn and look, a squad of uniformed men and women spread out among the workers in the parking lot.
They're looking for me, Straker said, watching Doris.
Why?
It's a spy exercise. I'm supposed to practice and train to escape and avoid being caught, and they're training to catch me. I have to pass this level to graduate to the next.
I'll help you escape, Doris squealed. I don't want you to get caught.
I was hoping you'd say that.
He let Doris lead him to a gray, featureless block of apartments. If it wasn't a bright, sunny day, the cityscape would look positively grim, reminding him of some of the mutuality towns he'd seen, uninterrupted by beauty or aesthetics. Everything seemed to be made of concrete, metal, or plastic. Everything had a discrete function. The few plants and trees seemed to be barely alive.
"Is this a diz?" he asked as Doris palmed open her door.
"What's that mean?"
"Never mind."
He looked around the tiny space. It reminded him of a cheap hotel room with no personal touches.
"How long have you lived here?"
"Just a month since I graduated from medical tech school."
Doris shut the door and immediately began kissing him again.
"Hold on, honey, slow down."
"Why?"
She shrugged off her jacket and let it drop to the floor. Straker wondered whether she'd continue losing clothes, but she didn't. She did, however, grab his face for more kisses.
"Because I need to think about escaping, remember?"
"Oh, that's right." She backed off slightly and then seized his hand once more.
"Let's sit down."
She sat on the bed, there was only one chair, and tried to draw him toward it. Straker let her pull him.
"First, I need information. We can kiss some more later."
"Okay.
What's this city called?"
"Glasgow."
"What happens here?"
Doris shrugged.
"I don't know. People live here. There's business and industry. It's normal."
"How do you know what's normal?"
She shrugged again.
"It seems normal.
I've always lived here."
Straker took a different tack.
"How old are you?"
22.
"Tell me about your life until now."
She faltered and then recited. "I was born in the Sandstone Creche. I was raised in the collective boarding school until 20. I went to medical technical school for a month, and I graduated last month, and now I'm here."
Wait.
Something wasn't right here, the numbers.
"You said you finished your boarding school at 20, then went to tech school for a month, but you've only been here a month. What happened to the rest of the 2 years between 20 and now?"
The question seemed to confuse Doris.
"A year is 12 months."
"It sure is, most places."
"That means 2 years is 24 months. I'm only 22.
Straker grabbed Doris by the shoulders and held her at arm's length.
"You're 22 months old?"
"Yes."
Ah,
he was kissing a baby. Even if she had a woman's hot body and face, and the emotional development of a middle schooler, it seemed. And no doubt, she was a virgin. Even if he hadn't been Carla's man, he wouldn't just jump Doris's bones here and now. The whole experience would confuse the young facet, and she'd no doubt be infatuated with him. At some point, he'd have to leave Doris behind, and Straker wasn't the love-'em-and-leave-'em type. That was Loco's department. Then he wondered why he even cared. Doris was a creature, barely a person, mass-produced by the Opters as a biological machine to do their bidding, a slug, Don had callously termed the type, though perhaps a bit better educated. Maybe that was why Straker cared. The innocence of all these facets like Doris, the helplessness, the hopelessness. What kind of fulfillment or accomplishments could come from lives like these? Then he wondered how long Doris had to live.
"Is something wrong?"
Straker tried not to look sad.
"Many things, honey. But nothing's wrong with you. You're perfect."
"Oh, you too," she squealed and took to kissing him again.
"Hey," he said around the smooching, "how long do the people here usually live?"
"That's a weird question."
"Is it?
For a medical tech?"
Doris frowned.
"I'm not a geriatric specialist. But how long? You must have some idea."
I'm not sure. Maybe 1,000?
Straker converted 1,000 months to years. 83 and change. So a relatively normal lifespan, give or take. The opters simply compressed 24 years of human development into 2, and the facets stayed adults for longer. But something didn't fit, at least with Doris.
Have you ever been anywhere else? Then Glasgow?
No.
I know there are other places, but most people don't get to travel until they're at least 50 or they get selected.
Selected, what's that? Doris shivered, and for the first time appeared afraid.
They say it's a good thing, but then they take people away, and they never come back? It doesn't feel good when they take someone away.
Those selected must be the ones to get run through the dizzes, the program to make facets into people who could function in human society, a forcible and cruel introduction to the worst of the real world. Then again, was it any worse than what he himself went through? Or what kids went through with dysfunctional families and badly run schools? Even Straker's special school had its problems with its bullies and cliques and childish cruelties. The passive-aggressive teachers sometimes secretly loved it when the super-capable kids failed, and the insecure staff enforced rules without using their judgment. In other schools he'd heard about, there were even adults who lusted after the budding adolescents in their charge. Funny. He hadn't thought of his pre-academy days in a long time, and that brought back memories of his family. His steady, loving father, his caring but fretful mother, his sister, all slaughtered by mutuality attackers who wanted Derek Straker dead. Not for the first time, he wondered how they knew which houses to strike, where the special children lived. Mutuality spies, he'd always thought. But now that he was aware of the Opter games, okay, to be fair, the Sarmak games, if he could believe Don, he wondered whether the spies hadn't actually been perfected facets, like Myrmidon himself. If the Sarmak wanted to sow trouble and keep the war going, they could have provided the information to the Mutuality and prompted the attack on Seaburn City. So in a way, the Sarmak might have killed his family.
Derek?
Sorry, I was thinking. You know, you're right about being selected. It is a bad thing. Anytime your government steals people away from their lives just because they can and forces them to be something they don't want to be, that's bad.
It sounds bad. But what happens to the selected?
They suffer. Many die. A few come out changed, and then they're sent to live somewhere else, far from family and friends.
What's family?
You don't know.
Of course not.
Straker took Doris's face in his hands, a face that if he'd encountered it before he met Carla, he might have fallen in love with, and kissed her forehead. Any ardor he'd felt toward her cooled. Now she seemed like a daughter, not an object of desire.
Sweetheart, family is people you love and who love you. The people who raise you, the people you're connected with, the people you defend, the people you die for.
I die for you, Derek,
she declared passionately. Straker sighed.
I'm sure you feel that way.
How could he explain that he knew how she was feeling, exactly how he'd felt when he fell in love with Carla, and how now he was so much older, so far beyond Doris, that he would never be what her adolescent hormones wanted him to be? He held Doris, and eventually spooned with her chastely on her narrow bed until she fell contentedly asleep. No doubt she was filled with the feeling of her first crush. As her breathing deepened, he used the time to think. He'd have to leave Doris behind, breaking her heart and leaving her life forever changed. He wondered if the facets in Glasgow were allowed to pair up, have sex and relationships and babies,
even if they weren't allowed to form families and raise their own children. Probably not. Don had talked about larval pods and vats. That seemed a horrible beginning to a lonely existence. This whole world, this whole planet, was an abomination. Bad enough that human governments or corporations, nations or collectives, separated people into the rulers and the ruled, the haves and the have-nots, the masters and the slaves. Those places, those planets, could be changed. Their regimes could be overthrown. People could be freed, had been freed, by Straker and the Liberation, to choose their own paths, to make their own destinies. He knew the new Earth and Republic wouldn't be perfect, but it would be better than the mutuality it replaced. There would always be those who wanted to lord it over others, to stand on their necks, to brutalize their bodies and pillage their hard-earned property, just to satisfy their lusts for power and control. This place took that evil to the next level. The overlords of this Terra Nova, such an irony he'd abolish the name if he ever could, weren't even human, and didn't see people as anything more than cogs in a vast machine. The Opter Queens sat atop the pile, the lives of their thralls worthless to them, including these odd human opts they'd grown in their pods and vats. Odd humans, he reminded himself. If they looked like humans, thought like humans, lived and died like humans, and wanted to make love like humans, even if they didn't know it yet, then they were humans. More human than Ruxans or the insectoid Opters, for sure. Chapter 11. Engels aboard Indomitable, Planetary Nebula, Calypso System. Admiral Engels admired Braga even as she gave orders to close the trap on his fleet and crush him. She couldn't imagine anyone doing any better than he'd done, given the tough circumstances. Comms, transmit our call for surrender again. No reply, ma'am. Set it to repeat every minute. She'd hoped for a response, but not really expected one. Not yet, anyway. Braga was a fighter. Indomitable had taken out 4 super dreadnoughts single-handedly, firing from beyond visual range using targeting data relayed from her stealth drone network. Undoubtedly, Braga would believe he faced at least 2 fortresses, unless he had better-than-expected data on the battleship. He also couldn't know how many supporting ships those fortresses had with them, and so would undoubtedly turn away, believing he'd already destroyed Felicity Station. Engels had deliberately ordered Indomitable's targeting and power adjusted downward from maximum effectiveness. At the current 200-kilometer range, her weaponry could have utterly destroyed those 4 SDNs, leaving no survivors and nothing but slag. That would have been a twofold mistake. Not only would it cause unnecessary casualties, but crippled ships could be repaired and rebuilt, or at least salvaged, and the Republic needed all the warships it could get. She had plenty of forces to compel their surrender. In fact, today's haul and prizes would provide a much-needed boost to Republic fleets, if they had the time to absorb them. Indomitable continued to pick off big ships with her main particle beam. The massive railgun became almost useless as soon as Braga's fleet turned unexpectedly away from a nose-on aspect toward the planet. Engels instantly divined Braga's intention, to drive a wedge between her battleship and the rest of her englobing fleet, to escape with what he could by slingshotting around C-1.
Helm, set course to cut them off, she ordered.
The ship's a pig, ma'am. We'll still end up chasing them.
Do your best. Weapons, continue maximum rate of fire, prioritizing undamaged big ships.
Aye, aye, ma'am. Inertial compensators and grav plating held Engels and the crew in place as Indomitable clawed her way around a semicircle, aiming her nose ahead of Braga's faster ships. Twice more, her great particle beam lashed out, crippling super dreadnoughts, before the gas became too dense to penetrate. Engels chewed a nail in thought as Indomitable slid in behind the enemy, chasing them like a buffalo hopelessly following swift wolves. What would she do if she were Braga? Where would he break away from C1's gravity? What direction would he take? Given his current course and actions, one thing made the most sense. She used her cursor to circle an area within Indomitable.